From The Recount, I'm Rena Ninen, and you're listening to The Recount Daily Pod. Today is Wednesday, October 27th.
Why do we assume that the current temper in Washington is forever? Nothing's forever. I think this is a fever, and fevers don't usually kill their hosts. They usually burn out.
That was George Will, renowned conservative columnist. I talked to him a bit later about America's current predicament and about his new book, American Happiness and Discontents. But first, your morning headlines. As Senate Democrats continue negotiations over a massive spending bill, they're preparing a proposal for how to pay for it. One idea? A tax increase that would hit just a few of the country's richest people. Think Elon Musk, Mark Zuckerberg, and Bill Gates. Truly just the uber wealthy. Some legal scholars believe such a targeted tax could be struck down by the Supreme Court. A competing idea from Democrats would apply a 3% surtax on millionaires making more than $5 million a year. Either way, with a cost of perhaps $1.75 trillion spread out over 10 years, that money's got to come from somewhere. College enrollment is down again. New data from the National Student Clearinghouse suggests there could be nearly 500,000 fewer freshmen this academic year compared to last. That's roughly a 3% drop on top of a 3.5% decrease last year. Enrollment in higher education has declined since 2012. The pandemic only fired up that trend. Even schools that conduct classes mostly online have suffered. All that lost education could, of course, have huge consequences on the future U.S. economy and on the lives of many Americans and families. And federal law enforcement on Tuesday announced 150 arrests, the result of a 10-month-long operation conducted by international law enforcement agencies against drug sellers on the dark net, hidden from most users. 65 of those arrests were made in the U.S., and the rest across Europe. Authorities seized more than 200,000 pills in the U.S., including some that were laced with deadly substances. As Assistant Attorney General Lisa Monaco put it,
"One pill can kill. Well, Operation Dark Hunter went after the illicit drug distributors who use the dark net to traffic these illicit drugs."
Other investigations are still ongoing, according to the Justice Department. And now to our interview. George Will has been a leading conservative voice for The Washington Post and other publications for decades. His columns, sometimes controversial, always sharp, cover politics, domestic, and foreign affairs. He's won a Pulitzer Prize for commentary, and he's made it onto Seinfeld as a topic of debate. Most recently, he's out with a collection of his essays. The book is called American Happiness and Discontents, The Unruly Torrent, 2008 to 2020. George, welcome.
Thank you. The first and last time my children took me serious was when I appeared on Seinfeld.
That is a huge moment. How did that come about?
I didn't know it was coming. I didn't see it when it happened, but instantly was informed by thousands of people.
Yeah, what a moment. So I want to ask you about your book, George. What motivated you to put this all together?
Between 2008 and 2020, the beginning of the Obama presidency and the end of the Trump presidency, we went through an era that I do not think historians are going to call the era of good feelings 2.0. Bitterness crept into our politics, and I was surprised to realize when I was assembling these columns how much I had written, not about politics, but about, I wrote a lot about parenting and the related fact that we seem to have now produced a large cohort of a generation that arrives on college campuses having experienced modern parenting, demanding safe spaces and not freedom of speech, but freedom from speech that might disturb their brittle selves. It turned out that in this 12-year period, there were cultural as well as, and indeed more important than, political developments.
George, I was first introduced to you as a little girl watching you on Sunday mornings on This Week with Cokie Roberts and Sam Donaldson, and you always had such a different take. How do you think from that period of when you were on television, I think that was in the 90s, how has the Republican Party changed?
The severest judgment is it stopped being a party in a normal sense and has become a cult of personality, a kind of performative institution for expressing grievances of its most intense acolytes at this point. Because their grievances have to do with status and a feeling of neglect and resentment of condescension, perceived condescension on the part of other Americans, I don't know how you write a law to assuage this sense of grievance.
You actually left the Republican Party in 2016 as it became clear that Trump would become the nominee. What do you see for the future of the Republican Party?
So one would like to think that when Mr. Trump departs, as surely he must someday, that certainly his manner of politics will depart. And some, not all of the substance, because he clearly struck some chords with people. And there will be Republicans who will try and pluck up the fallen banner of populism. But conservatism, it seems to me, is just about everything that populism isn't. Populism says that the passions of the people are self-validating. They should be translated as directly as possible into public policy, which means you need a president unfettered by the separation of powers and all that other Madisonian architecture. So conservatives have to decide, do they want to go down this populist road of a rampant presidency, of a rancid anti-elitism?
George, I want to ask you about President Trump. It's clear you are no fan. You actually called for his removal last summer, and you wrote this. You said, he's proven that the phrase malignant buffoon is not an oxymoron. That said, he's managed to get three conservative judges onto the high court. Looking at his time in office, for conservatives, was that worth it?
Yes, it's the Butt Gorsuch argument. Yes, he's a liar. Yes, he exacerbates social tensions. Yes, he has coarsened our public life, but Gorsuch, I got that. Now, any Republican would have taken basically a list from the Federalist Society, just as any Republican would have cut corporate taxes. Good grief, that's not what distinguished Mr. Trump. What distinguished Mr. Trump are the way he behaved and the coarsening of our public life. It seems to me you cannot unring a bell. You cannot unsay the things he said. You cannot resensitize an electorate desensitized by the coarseness of the man and his indifference to facts.
Do you worry about a loss of legitimacy? Public support for the Supreme Court, one poll found, is down to 49%. That was 60% in July, and last year, 66%. This is the Supreme Court. You've spent a large part of your career covering it.
That's true. The Supreme Court got an enormous infusion of prestige from the 1954 Brown v. Board of Education, school desegregation, and it got the prestige precisely because it acted against prevailing public opinion, not just in the South, but in the North as well. But prestige is a perishable commodity. And I think part of the diminished prestige of the court is simply the withdrawal of prestige from government generally on the part of the American people, not specific to the Supreme Court. But you're quite right, the Supreme Court, partly because of the contentiousness and unseemliness of the nomination, the confirmation fights in the Senate Judiciary Committee over nominees, has made the court seem partisan and soiled.
We've got to take a quick break, and we'll be right back with George Will, author of American Happiness and Discontents. You're listening to The Recount Daily Pod. Welcome back to The Recount Daily Pod, a podcast from The Recount and iHeartRadio. I'm joined by George Will, and we're talking about his new book, American Happiness and Discontents. 2014, one of your most criticized columns in recent years, you suggested that women who report sexual assault on campuses actually enjoyed privileged status, and rape and sexual assault on campus was really a hotly discussed issue at the time, partially because of that column. St. Louis Dispatch ended up dropping you as a columnist, but you chose to include that column in this book. Why?
Well, what I said in the column was about three things. I said a woman can say no before sex, she can say no. During sex, she can't say no 6 weeks later when she's decided she doesn't like her sexual partner after all. Second, that due process should not be suspended. That is, this is an extremely serious accusation. It's a felony, sexual assault, and it should be the business of the criminal justice system, not jerry-built campus tribunals. And third, that it unquestionably is the case that various grievance groups on campus feel that by establishing themselves as victims, they can get marvelous attention and, in some cases, special status and privileges on campuses. Just hence the proliferation of grievance groups. The incentives are there.
I also want to ask you about China. You've written quite a bit about it. There's building tension between the U.S. and China. Australia's planned purchase of nuclear submarines involving the U.S. and U.K. It only added fuel to the fire. And then we've got this new report that China just tested a nuclear-capable hypersonic missile in August. Where do you see the relationship between China and the U.S. headed? What are you watching?
There's never been anything quite like this in American history. Since the United States became a superpower, we are now competing with a peer in a way that the Soviet Union was not. China is culturally dynamic, economically muscular, and innovative. That's the sense in which this is not just a near peer, this is a peer rival. And we're in this for the long haul. And the competition for things like hypersonic weapons and anti-satellite capabilities could simply blind the United States. This is dangerous and fast-moving and largely secret for necessary reasons, but what's going on in laboratories and out on the high seas in the United States Navy is, as I say, without precedent, either in the scale of the danger or the fast-moving changes of it.
What would you say the Biden administration should do at this point?
The heart of the matter is Taiwan. The Taiwan Straits has replaced, in my judgment, the 38th parallel in Korea as the most dangerous place in the world. Since the Shanghai communique back in the 70s, the United States has maintained strategic ambiguity about our commitment to Taiwan. We are statutorily committed to enabling Taiwan to defend itself. We are not committed to participating in that defense. However, the Japanese, one of whose islands, which they claim is about 80 miles from China, the Japanese have indicated that to the extent that the United States is militarily involved in the defense of Taiwan, Japan will be also. The submarine deal that you have just cited about Australia indicates that Australia has come off the fence. It's no longer neutral. So strategic ambiguity may be being diluted to the point of disappearance. We may wind up committed, in which case, when President Xi says we cannot pass the problem of China, the renegade province, as they say, down from generation to generation, and it just could be that the American admiral was onto something when he said he thinks within 6 years, China will think the window is open, but not forever, and will try to act militarily. That's the big dangers. And what the Biden administration has to do is decide whether or not we should plant the flag there by eliminating ambiguity and being committed to the military defense of Taiwan.
We're going to take a quick break. We'll be right back with George Will, author of the new book, American Happiness and Discontents, on the Recount Daily Pod. Welcome back to the Recount Daily Pod, a podcast from The Recount. I'm joined by George Will. We're talking about his new collection of columns, American Happiness and Discontents. One thing that people can say about you is you've always, I felt, kept your personal life personal. And you're not one of these Washington people to flash it. But in 2012, you wrote a remarkable column about your eldest child, Jonathan, who was born with Down syndrome. Tell me a little bit more about why you chose to write that column and what was in that column.
I wrote about John for several reasons. First, because of in utero medicine and because of the screening of pregnant women before birth, you can identify Down syndrome children, and 90% of those who are identified in utero are aborted, which I think is unfortunate. And the world would be a better place if there were more people like John. Iceland, there's a column in my latest collection about Iceland, seemed rather proud of itself when it said we're just about eliminated, literally, genocide, getting rid of a genus, a category of people. But also, and there are lots of people in this country, many hundred thousand of people with experience with Down syndrome, and they need encouragement. And I frequently get letters from people will say, we just had a child with Down syndrome. What do we expect? I can help them with that. John, when he was born in Georgetown Hospital on my birthday in 1972, a hospital of official came in and said, well, first question you have to answer is, are you going to take him home? But in 1972, it was acceptable to say you might put John up for adoption. The life expectancy of a Down syndrome child was 20. John will be 50.
Wow.
When you're not isolated, when you're stimulated, I mean, John whips around Washington on the Washington Metro much more agilely than I do. He works in the clubhouse of the Washington National baseball team when protocols aren't in place, which means he gets up in the morning and goes to a major league ballpark. I just think it's encouraging, and it should, I hope, cause them to think, I've got four children. As far as I can tell, none of them are perfect.
As a mom of two, absolutely right. Before you go, I want to ask about one thing you say in the book is, and I'm quoting, for Americans, the pursuit of happiness is happiness. What do you mean?
Albert Camus, the French novelist, playwright, philosopher, wrote an essay called The Myth of Sisyphus about the man who's constantly rolling a boulder up to the top of a mountain and he constantly rolls back down. Camus' final line is, one imagines Sisyphus happy. That is, Camus said, and I agree, the striving is the pleasure, the pursuit of happiness. Happiness is the pursuit of happiness. One of the things that makes America exceptional is that our Constitution does not tell what the government must do for us, but what the government may not do to us. And what the government may not do to us is define happiness for us and deliver it. That's one of the exceptional features of the American Revolution is we didn't say the revolution is going to deliver happiness. Revolution means government's going to get out of the way and let us get on with pursuing happiness as we define it. That's what I mean.
George, you know, you and Cokie were a huge part of the reason why I chose to come to George Washington University and come to D.C., study politics. And I just feel the Washington, D.C. I arrived in freshman year in 1997 is a very different place today. So polarized. Do you see that ever changing?
Nothing lasts. The continents are drifting, for Pete's sake. So why do we assume the current temper in Washington is forever? Nothing's forever. I think this is a fever, and fevers don't usually kill their host. They usually burn out. And I think there will be ferocity fatigue. People are tired of being up on their tiptoes with their teeth clenched and their fists clenched and all the rest. Someone's going to come along and have as profound and benign effect on the public temper as the 45th president had in a negative way. Just think Americans are not happy being unhappy, and they don't want to feel that way about their country.
The book is called American Happiness and Discontents, The Unruly Torrent, 2008 to 2020. George, so grateful you could join us.
Thank you for having me.
And now, let's look ahead at what's happening today. The Senate Judiciary Committee will hold a hearing on oversight of the Department of Justice later this morning. If it's anything like last week's House Oversight Committee, topics could range from the U.S. Capitol attack to gun violence and the opioid epidemic. Attorney General Merrick Garland will attend. He's expected to face criticism over a Justice Department memo that Republicans claim ties anti-mask parents with domestic terrorism. The memo actually did not reference domestic terrorists. Earlier this month, Garland asked the FBI to connect with local law enforcement to address a spike in threats against educators over issues like mask mandates and teaching around racial issues. And the House Intelligence Committee will be holding a hearing on diversity in the intelligence community. According to a report last year by the Office of the Director of National Intelligence, minorities made up only 27% of the workforce and women 39%. The intelligence community's 17 agencies are less diverse than even the federal government overall. Last summer, the CIA ran its first ever television recruiting ad featuring a diverse cast of young staffers.
Your achievements, while unknown to the public, are critical to our national security.
This translation is technically accurate, but in this context, it really means this.
The nation is counting on you.
Witnesses will include CIA Director William Burns and the Director of National Intelligence, Avril Haines. Looking for some new reading glasses? Sotheby's will auction off two pairs of diamond-encrusted eyeglasses today. The Gate of Paradise has emerald lenses. The other object, Halo of Light, holds lenses made of, yes, more diamonds. The lenses are said to hail from 17th century India's Mughal Empire. The frames date back to the late 19th century. Each artifact is expected to fetch up to $3.5 million. No word on whether you can actually get them to match your prescription. This is the Recount Daily Pod, a podcast from The Recount. Our thanks to George Will for being on the show. And if you like this episode, I hope you'll subscribe to The Recount Daily Pod and do leave us a rating on the Apple Podcast app. I'm your host, Rena Ninen.